So it's so wonderful to bring to have Susanna Heschel here at the GTU again. I think this is the third time, right? In not that many years. Maybe it's even the fourth time. It is, it's the fourth time. So whenever she's around, we're very happy to have her. Let me tell you who Susanna Heschel is. She's the, in case you don't know, I have a feeling that lots of you already know, but she's the Eli Black Professor of Jewish Studies at Dartmouth College, who works, she works on various Jewish-Christian relations, and now her new work is about Jewish-Islamic relations, the history of anti-Semitism. Her many publications include Abraham Geiger and the Jewish Jesus, an award, I think National Jewish Book Award winning book, and The Aryan Jesus, Christian Theologians in the Bible in Nazi Germany. She's presently working on Jewish scholarship around Islam in 19th century Germany. I didn't ask you, is that finished or it's still a work in progress?
I have a book coming out this summer,
Oh,
but that's
wonderful.
in German, and then the English book will come a year
Ah,
later.
do you want to say what it's called?
The German,
Yeah. Well, just say, oh, it doesn't matter.
But I'm giving a lecture about it tomorrow night at the Bancroft Hotel.
Oh, thank you for reminding me to publicize that. So for those of you who want to learn more about Susanna Heschel's own really interesting and important scholarship, tomorrow she'll be speaking at the Bancroft Hotel. It's an event that's organized by the Center for Jewish Studies at UC Berkeley.
And it's at 6 p.m.
6 p.m.
Reception at 5:15.
5:15, yeah.
5:15, oh, good. Some people are checking their email. And actually, I can't believe this isn't in your Wikipedia page, but a really, really important pioneering work that Susanna was edited was On Being a Jewish Feminist, which I think is 1973? 83, which is, yeah, of course, which is really the beginning of Jewish feminism and a classic in the literature. So join me in welcoming Susanna Heschel. And this was her idea that I would interview her about her father, and I'm very pleased. I'm also terrified, of course, but I'm very pleased. Terry Gross is my big. I didn't say you were a Guggenheim fellow, too.
And Naomi Seidman has just won a Guggenheim fellowship.
But it turns out you don't get to go on fresh air when that happens.
And she won the NEH Senior Scholar Grant at the Center for Jewish History in New York.
Thank you. So the reason I'm so excited is because I don't know if any of you have friends who are the children of famous people, but it's a very odd thing. So let me tell you. So my partner is a musician. One of his closest musical colleagues is the grandson of Frank Lloyd Wright. He lives about three blocks away from us. I don't know how we know that he's the grandson of Frank Lloyd. It's like everybody who knows him knows that, and we have never mentioned it. About a month ago, my husband had a gig with him. It was like a long drive, and it was just the two of them. And when he basically decided that this was going to be the moment that he was going to have a conversation with him about his grandfather, and he walked in the door, and I said, "So?" And he said, "I do it." So I know Susanna Heschel for at least 20 years. She's been just such a supportive colleague and friend. She gave me my first paying gig. And it was so much money. Anyway, I just owe her so much, but let's just say I've never had this conversation with her. I've never just sat down and said, "Okay, can we know each other? Can we have this conversation?" We've never done it. The closest we came was this morning. I crashed a breakfast she was having with Michael Lerner and said, "What should I ask you?" So that's how far we've gotten along this path. So I basically feel so happy that I get to ask all the questions that I've always wanted to ask. So thank you for that. Okay, I am going to shut up in a second. But here's my first question about your father. I'm really interested in this path that so many Jewish intellectuals took from an Orthodox or Hasidic background, especially in the 19th century, especially in the Haskalah, to then acquire a secular education. And many of these people, I mean, many of the people we know about fit into this pattern. And your father kind of does and kind of doesn't, right? I mean, what I want to know about is, tell me about his Hasidic childhood and how did he go from there to getting a PhD in Jewish studies in Germany? And I mean, obviously lots of other things happened, but could you just give us some insight into that particular path?
Sure. So I think that the standard path that you're thinking of that we talked about earlier was the Haskalah path of someone who's Orthodox, leaves it behind and becomes secular, quote unquote. So this seems to be a bit odd. How is it? He doesn't throw it all away to go with my father to get a PhD and become an academic. On the contrary, what he did was to bring his Hasidic background and what he was exposed to in the Hasidic world, he brought that to the University of Berlin with a critical eye. And actually, is Munir still here? Because there's some
Hi.
You know, I think that there are some interesting parallels in the critique that my father brought to Berlin, where he said these professors just don't understand what it is to be religious. And it reminds me of some of the critique I read in people like Shidyak from 19th century Muslim intellectuals, or in his case, Christian intellectual from Lebanon who comes to Europe and takes a look and writes about the experience. It's not just Shidyak, but other Tahtawi and others as well. Muhammad Abdu and so on. So there is so what was the background that my father had, you ask? And my father, first of all, my father grew up in Warsaw. He was the son of a Rebbe. My father's father, my grandfather, grew up in the court of the Sadeger Rebbe, which was a very elegant and very prominent court, a very important Hasidic Rebbe. It's a suburb, Sadeger, of Chernovitz. And it's a very important place. And he grew up there because his mother was married, but her husband died when my grandfather was a little boy. So she took him back to her father, to the Sadegera, and he grew up there. It was very elegant. Whoa. That's it, dramatic too. And that's good, it's because it's a dramatic point that my grandfather left that behind and became a Rebbe in Warsaw in the most impoverished Jewish neighborhood. And I want to mention this is, you know, I think that means something, and I think it's very telling. It tells you something also about how he saw the world, about his political responsibility and religious responsibility, and how the two are intertwined. And that tells you something about my father's background. And I could say also my father had an older brother who was in England and was an Orthodox rabbi, and he too had, what shall I say, very liberal politics. I don't know how, that's not a good expression, but you know what I mean. But my father's background was from the most distinguished Hasidic families, the Rebbes of Europe. He, for those of you who know, he was descended from the Abt Rav. My father was named for the Abt Rav, of Rav Yeshua Heschel of Abt, who was invited by Baruch of Mezhbish, the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, to come to Mezhbish to revive the tradition of the Baal Shem Tov. My father also was descended from the Rishoner, who was a different kind of tradition. And on my father's mother's side, he was descended from Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev. And my grandfather used to say, my father's father used to say to my father, I envy you your yichus, because he had Levi Yitzchak. And then he was also descended from the Maggid of Mezrich. So
tell us a story that he told you about his childhood.
Well, what he said about his childhood was that he felt that he was surrounded by children, by people of religious nobility, which I think is a very important phrase, religious nobility. And this is why that book by Ed Kaplan annoys me. Somebody writes a book about my father, and he tells you that every day my grandfather ate soup for lunch. Is that important to know? What does that mean? I don't know.
What is religious nobility?
What does that mean? And how do you imagine that? And how do you put that into words? So I'll just tell you what one story that my father used to tell often, which is a story about the Abt Rav. That the Abt Rav had a lot of, it's a very, a person with enormous empathy.
And people would come to see him every day, all the time, and they would come to see him to tell them the problems and ask him to pray for a sick child, to pray for a parnasa, to earn a living, to pray for shidduch, that the child should get married. And this was done with a lot of rebbes, but he in particular was someone people went to, and they would pour out their hearts, pour out their troubles. And so the story is that one day his assistant asked him, how do you remember all these people? At the end of the day, all of these dozens of people come to you and they pour out their problems and ask you to pray for them. And the Apta Rav said, when somebody comes to me and they tell me their problem, I open my heart and their problem comes into my heart and makes a scar. And when I go to pray, I open my heart to God and I say, look at all these scars. So I think that exemplified for my father what it means, what is a Rebbe, for one thing. It also what was the kind of person my father was. And I think it's important for us too, because, you know, just think about it. If you had the opportunity to talk to such a person, to talk to someone so you knew, you felt when you're talking to this person that actually your trouble is making a scar in their heart. Mm-hmm. For you, that's an amazing experience. And then, of course, to be such a person.
It's interesting. It doesn't, you know, he didn't say he's helping them. He's helping them only by being pained.
He's praying for them. Yeah. I mean, a Rebbe also would give you money if you needed it. He would put you in touch with a doctor if you needed, or advise you how to do it,
or
put you in touch with some of the other Hasidim. It's a community, and you help each other.
So let me ask you something else. So your father grew up in this, basically this aristocracy of these Hasidic dynasties that went all the way back to the beginning. He ended up as a professor in the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, which is the conservative, for those of you who don't know, is the conservative seminary. I don't know whether he affiliated as a conservative Jew. He didn't. So he went, and I know there was also a kind of sojourn in Reform Judaism. So he went through the denominational landscape, and he seemed to, would you say he was post-denominational, or was he, what was he? How do you describe him in the landscape of denominational American Judaism?
I mean, you can't pigeonhole him. It's like that, yeah. No, he, first of all, my father got smicha in Warsaw, you know, from Menachem Zemba, you know who that is?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, who was a great, great halachic authority of his day. And then he went first to Vilna briefly, and then he went to Berlin. And in Berlin, he already was ordained a rabbi from Zemba. So, but what did he do? He studied at the University of Berlin to do a PhD, but he also went to the Orthodox Seminary and the Reform Seminary. And he took classes in both places and taught in both places, was friendly in both places. Why would he go to Reform? He wanted to understand what they were learning. What is this historical critical method? And he wanted to be with the Orthodox, more of his background, who he was. And my father was there in Germany, went there in 1927. And by the way, nobody went back and forth between these two seminaries. Nobody. It was unheard of. They were both located in the same street, a couple of blocks apart. And the street used to be known as Artillery Street.
Oh my God.
It's very fitting. And next door to the Reform Seminary was the dormitory for the Protestant theology students. And they also didn't communicate, sadly enough. So, he went, my father finished his PhD, and that's another story, but when he finally was able to get out of Europe, his life was saved by Hebrew Union College, which got visas from the State Department, which was very miserly, and they gave only 5 visas, and my father was one of the people who was saved, one of the 5 refugee scholars brought to this country. So he didn't go to Hebrew Union College because he was Reform. And what was Reform in Germany was not the same as in America, because the students in Germany had really a strong background.
and the students in America were just learning Hebrew. It was a very difficult time. He spent the 5 years of the war. You can imagine how he felt. And he felt very grateful. He saved his life, but he was struggling to save his mother and his three sisters. It was a terrible, terrible time. But he, at the end, toward the end of the war, he met my mother, who was a pianist and who was studying in Cincinnati. And
that probably helped a little.
And the reason,
he was very lonely during the war. Yes, very broken, and
it was a terrible time.
Yeah,
but he moved to New York. He got a position at the Jewish Theological Seminary. You want to ask why? He wasn't. No one on the faculty of the seminary was conservative. No one, no one there went to a conservative synagogue. They wouldn't. They wouldn't go to a conservative synagogue. They were teaching there because they were all from Europe. They're all refugees. Where else could you teach?
Uh-huh.
So they taught there. And they really wouldn't fit into Yeshiva University. They really were a little bit more critical, but not no conservative. Mm-hmm. Men and women sitting there, no.
So your father wouldn't sit, go to a synagogue where men and women
no,
sat
No, my
together?
Father did. My father would go. Sometimes he would give a sermon. He was invited to be scholar in residence at a synagogue. And then there was my bat mitzvah. My bat mitzvah, I wanted. Should I
talk? Absolutely. Who here does not want to hear about Susanna Heschel's bat mitzvah?
So I went to Ramaz, which is an Orthodox so-called alleged school. Is more like a, anybody here went to Ramaz? Anybody here went to a reformatory?
Anyone here from out of town? Yeah. Anyway, everyone here is from out of town.
It was the kind of school where they taught by humiliation. If you didn't know, you know, you were stand in the corner and you're terrible. Anyway, boys and girls sat separately in the room, etc. And at our synagogue, we went to pray at the Jewish Theological Seminary synagogue where men sat on one side, women on the other. And I want to just tell you something. I used to go as a little girl and sit with my father in the synagogue. And then all of a sudden, when I was about 7 years old, the women from the women's side, the faculty wives, and the, you know, it was all hierarchical. I don't know if you, the wives of the senior faculty sat in the first rows, then the junior faculty after that, then the students, so the wives of the rabbinical staff, and then the et cetera, et cetera. And the college students way in the back. Yeah. Okay. So these women, faculty wives, elderly women, most of whom did not have children, came over to me to tell me that I had to go and sit on their side. Now, they didn't invite me and say, we would love you, little girl, come and sit with, no. It was punitive, and it really only occurred to me a few years ago. Why did they made it punitive.
Get off your father's
get
rack,
out, and
you
have to
girl.
You have to come over here.
I totally remember that, also being kicked out of the men's section.
That's it.
You're too big to be sitting on your father's lap.
Yes.
What did your father do?
What could he do? What could he do? Some chastori came and danced with me with the Sefer Torah, by the way, while the women were standing on the side watching. And he came over.
Okay.
All right, anyway, so I wanted a bat mitzvah, and I wanted it on Shabbat morning, and I wanted to chant the Haftorah. It never occurred to me to say the Torah, because it was beyond. Nobody, I'd never been to a bat mitzvah. It wasn't such a thing. It didn't exist. So my parents invited the chancellor of the seminary, Louis Figelstein, to our home for tea, Shabbat afternoon tea. That was what everybody did. He came for tea. So I asked him, Professor Finkelstein, tell me about Martin. What do you think about Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement? So he was very proud. He supports it, Dr. King. Yes, equality. I let him talk, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then I said, good, good. And now, what about equality for women? I want a bat mitzvah. And then he said, I'll make you in my house. We'll have cookies and cake, and you'll have your bat mitzvah. Anyway,
you should have asked Dr. Martin Luther King for a bat mitzvah. He would have been right. That would have been good music, too.
That would have been great. Wow.
I guess we're on the big subject. I just want to ask you, I mean, there's two big ones. I don't know which one to go first. I'll start with civil rights. So how did your father get involved with the civil rights movement?
So my father, I think it's actually very striking. 2 weeks ago, I had lunch with Cornel West in New York, who Mazel Tov just got married to a wonderful Jewish woman in Boston, Leslie. Anyway, he said to me, he thinks my father is the most important and most vigorous white spokesperson in America about racial equality since William Garrison in the 19th century, which I think is dramatic.
Wow.
There's a book by James Cone, C-O-N-E Cone, called The Lynching Tree, where he compares my father to Reinhold Niebuhr. And he says, look, Niebuhr was very dry, and my father was very passionate. Why is that? He said, well, Niebuhr's voice, he said, became more passionate after he got to know James Baldwin. Now, my father never had the opportunity to meet James Baldwin. He never had black colleagues at the Jewish Theological Seminary or black students or black friends. He lived in I grew up in a very small little social world, my parents' world of faculty, mostly European Jewish refugee scholars. So where does the passion come from? My father was invited in 1963 to Chicago to a conference on religion and race, and that's where he spoke, and he said, and you maybe some of you know this, yes. What did he say in the opening? At the first summit?
It was Moses and Pharaoh.
Yes.
Hey, I just got 5 Heschel points.
Right. And Moses said to Pharaoh, let my people go.
The first conference on race and religion. Was in Egypt. And it was, right? It was,
yeah.
So that was, so tell us more about that story.
And he said, racism is Satanism. Unmitigated evil.
Yes.
It's idolatry. And when he said Moses spoke to Pharaoh, he was telling Jews, too, that Jews are also Pharaoh.
Yes.
Don't think that because you're Jewish, you're somehow on the other side.
Why was he invited? I mean, did he already?
This was 1963, and he was already well known as a writer, as a speaker, and he had been invited to some important national meetings. the White House Conference on Childhood and Youth, another White House Conference on Aging, and the AMA invited him to speak. He gave a speech on the patient as a person. And the AMA heard, I was with my parents, it was here in San Francisco at the Fairmont Hotel in Nob Hill. We stayed there. And the night before the lecture, the day before, my father was getting phone calls, a lot of pressure not to give the speech or to tone it down. The AMA was not happy that my father was going to be critical of doctors. And of course, he didn't tone it down. And the next day, the San Francisco newspaper said, the headline, the bitter pill of Abraham Heschel. Because he chastised the doctors for not treating people as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So he gets involved.
So that's where he met Martin Luther King.
That's where he met Martin Luther King. So he's a European born, Hasidic raised professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary. All of a sudden, his world must have opened pretty tremendously. Did he become? Was he just somebody who would get together with these people at marches or at conferences, or was your house suddenly filled with all kinds of interesting people that you're going to tell us about? or some of both?
Yeah, and my father wanted very much to have quiet time to write. My father was always studying, always reading, always. My parents rarely went out. My father didn't like the idea of entertainment. Celebration, but not entertainment. So maybe twice they went to a movie.
What did they see?
They occasionally would go to the theater, and usually they would come back and say it was a waste of time. And the theater, I can tell you, they went to see the play Luther, that was based on Erickson's book. They went to see...
Music?
They went to concerts, because my mother was a musician. The Deputy, they went to see. Things like that, things that were serious, heavy duty. We did go to see Fiddler on the Roof.
So did we.
But but really day and night. My father would come home from the office around 6. We'd have dinner. He'd listen to the 7 o'clock news with Walter Cronkite, and then either go back to his office at the seminary or stay at home and go to his desk and work until 11. And then he and my mother would have a cup of tea at the dining room table, and sometimes they would play Chinese checkers. And they would talk.
So did you ever meet Martin Luther King?
Sure.
Yes. You have to pull it out of her.
Yeah.
Please tell us.
He was extremely kind and generous and sweet. And so just to give you one example. I think that he and my father really cared about each other in a deep way. And I can tell you that there were some people who really loved my father. And I could tell that their love for him was genuine. And King was one of them, one of those people. And it extended to his family, to Mrs. King, who wanted me very much to become friends with her daughter, Yolanda. And we did. And we actually were here in California giving talks together at Mills College and at a synagogue in Berkeley and so on. Reinhold Niebuhr was another one. He really loved my father. So there were individuals like that. And Dr. King, just like one story, so it was just 10 days before he was assassinated, there was a meeting of the rabbinical assembly of the conservative rabbis at the Concord Hotel in the Catskills. And they invited Dr. King to give the keynote. And it was after dinner, and all the rabbis and their wives, because there were no women rabbis, went into the auditorium. There were hundreds of people. And then when Dr. King walked into the room, everybody stood up and linked arms, because this is how we, yeah? And sang, "We Shall Overcome" in Hebrew. And it was great. Those were the days when we used to do that. Do you remember? So, and anyway, it was wonderful, and my father spoke, and Dr. King spoke, and it was great. And then after that, it was late. And I went over, my father and Dr. King wanted to go somewhere to talk privately, and my father said to Dr. King, "Do you remember Susie?" That's me. And, you know, I thought, me? Why would he remember me? I'm a nobody. I'm just a kid. And he could have said, "Oh, yes, yes." But instead he said, with this exuberance, "Of course I remember Susie." And he was so warm and so friendly and so genuine in his warmth. And I was very touched. And then because he wanted to talk to my father privately, he got one of his assistants to take care of me, to babysit me, which was also thoughtful and sweet. Mm. He really was an amazing person. You can know somebody at the end of the evening when you're exhausted and you just, to be that warm and be so generous. He gave me a gift.
What was your father like as a father?
My father was a wonderful father. He was full of love and warmth. He was also funny, and he loved jokes, and he loved to play. And when I was little, he used to say when he was a little boy, all he had could only study, that's it. And so he never had toys. So he enjoyed it. He liked to play. And so he would play with me, and that was great. And then when I was older, he was very, very warm and very loving and full of enthusiasm. If I went out for the day, for the afternoon, I would come home, and he was so excited and so warm when I came, so happy to see me as if I had been gone for weeks, and exuberant.
Yeah.
And his warm.
Did you feel, so I'm very much related to the parent, you know, who believes that all kinds of things are a waste of time. Did he feel that you were wasting your time? Was he critical of you if you weren't, I don't know, doing something worthy? But you were always doing something worthy, clearly, right?
No, I watched TV. He didn't like the TV. That's true. That's true. Yeah. But no, I think he was. He really wasn't critical.
How famous was he when you were a kid? And when did you figure out you had a famous father?
You know, my parents would say, look, you know, your father's in the newspaper or the New York. I would say, oh, there are hundreds of people in the newspaper every day. I'll tell you the truth. It was not that. It was that when my father was at the seminary, he was really given a hard time.
Yeah.
As you know. And so my parents would talk about it with each other, but they didn't want me to know. So they would talk about F and L. Finkelstein and Lieberman. What? I couldn't figure it out? And I would just listen to this and finally told them, you think I don't know? Okay. So all of the unpleasantness and the misery, and they did at times really hurt my father. Mm-hmm. And that was terrible. And there was a lot of jealousy, et cetera. On the other hand, I have to say, my father used to say to me, never become an academic. It's too painful. And it is. Academics are horrible. It's such a wonderful life. Why be so nasty?
So let me just see how many people out there have a faint glimmer about what Susanna's talking about. I don't mean in general about academics. I mean JTS, politics. How the rest of you, are you interested?
Yes.
I want to know what happened to her about mitzvah. All we heard, we got left with cookies.
No. I, of course, wasn't interested in his party with cookies. That was ridiculous. No, my father arranged at a local conservative synagogue that was 10 blocks away, within walking distance, Anshe Chesed. We went there, and the rabbi was very accommodating, and normally what they had, they didn't do, no organ, no choir, no cantor, none of that. It was a straight service, straight davening in Hebrew, and my father took the Maftir Aliyah. He was called to the Torah. You have to understand, this was such a new thing. I didn't even ask for that. But he took the Aliyah, and then I went up and said the blessings over the Haftorah, and I chanted the Haftorah. And my father held my hand while I was doing it, which was really wonderful. And then my parents' request, I had to give two speeches, one in Hebrew and one in English. Yes, and so did my daughter Avigail. My daughter Gittel, my older daughter.
She did it in Yiddish and German.
German, Hebrew, English, and German. We were in Berlin at the time. She gave three different speeches in three different languages.
What do you mean different? The one translation?
No. Each on a different topic. Three.
Are some of you relieved not to actually be Susanna's daughter?
We were in Berlin for the year. I was on a fellowship, so that's how it happened. And she read from both of my girls read the Torah reading, and they did the Haftorah and so on.
So anyway, you know, I definitely want to. There will be time. I'm just going to ask a couple more questions. We'll get some information on the table. Maybe we'll leave the politics of the Jewish Theological Seminary to one side for the moment, unless you want to talk about it.
That's okay.
And I'll ask a few more questions, and then we'll open it up, because I know you all have questions, too. So one question that came up is, so your father actually, you know, had many students. I don't know how many, and I don't know exactly who they are. What would you say is, aside from what we know of as the legacy of his participation in the civil rights movement, or maybe not aside from that, that legacy, what you think happened to that, you know, those amazing moments of him marching with Dr. King, and what you think happened to him as a teacher, who his students are, what the continuation of it. I mean, obviously his works are taught in classrooms everywhere, but what's the legacy in terms of students and that kind of thing?
Well, those are many questions.
It's
I always
true.
Take, first of all,
I'm squeezing them all in.
My father used to say that he felt he was understood better by Christians than by Jews. in his lifetime.
Well, we got some around here. So
it took the Jewish world a while to catch up to him. Hmm. When my father marched in Selma, nobody was happy about that. He was by himself. His colleagues, of course, weren't there. And it was only about 10 years after my father died that Jews started talking in an appreciative way and saying, oh, your father was in Selma, and making the picture important and so on.
Why is that?
Did you know the book by Michael Staub, Torn at the Roots?
No.
No. So he has a chapter. He collected some of the comments made by Jewish leaders who were opposed to Jewish involvement in the civil rights movement. And you'd be surprised what people were saying. You can take a look. It really wasn't a popular thing in the larger Jewish world. Yes, there were some young Jews, of course. They were freedom riders.
But there weren't so many his age.
And there were rabbis.
With a Yiddish accent.
There were rabbis in Selma. There were German Jewish refugee rabbis, for example, who were involved. And there was Saul Berman,
right,
for instance,
right,
who used to be here once. Anyway, so,
is there two final questions?
You want to know about the students.
If you want to talk about it.
I would say one of the things that, since we're in Berkeley, I feel I can talk openly. Is that true?
It's just between us.
You know, my father had some students who surrounded him and who were really kind of disciples and took seminars with him. And they went in different directions. Some of them became very creative. I think about Peter Geffen, who started the Heschel School in New York and who was with my father in civil rights work. And Jonathan Levine is another one. And then there were some who were more academic, like Reuven Kimmelman or Arthur Green, who took the classes but didn't do the political work. And so they're different kinds. Some of them who were devoted to my father became very right-wing politically. Seymour Siegel, for instance, who gave the benediction at Nixon's inauguration. My father was appalled. Or Sam Dresner, who was leading the charge against the ordination of women, against ordination of lesbian and gay Jews, and so on. I don't understand that, frankly. I can't imagine somebody. But what they said to themselves, what they said to one another was, if my father had lived longer, he would have become a Republican.
Okay, that goes right into the next question.
And then there are people who were students and who were inspired by him, like Michael Lerner, who lives here in Berkeley, who met my father because of Camp Ramah. I was a camper and very homesick. Michael was a counselor. He was older. And I was so homesick that my parents came to live in a cabin at the camp for the summer. And thanks to my homesickness, Michael Lerner got to meet my father.
Oh, my God. You've just, you know, marching with Dr. King and so on, that's something like moving into the camp with your kid. There's a special level of... You know, it's completely ridiculous to say if your father had lived. I mean, would that he have lived, right? But if your father had lived, what would he have said about this? What would he have said about that? But if anyone could say that, right, if it's not completely out of line, did he pass away in 1972? So you then went on to become a pioneering feminist. And I know you've been working a lot on Israel-Palestine issues, justice.
Not a lot. Okay, yeah.
Okay, none of us are doing enough, but you're doing more than me. Is it fair to ask, do you think, can you hear his voice in your head when you do the work you do, what he would think, what kind of intimations while he was still alive of what peace and justice could be in Israel-Palestine, what a feminist Jewish world would look like?
Well, I think some things are pretty obvious because they're the same. He would have been appalled by racism. He would have been appalled that all of a sudden the Ku Klux Klan is standing in Trump rallies and cheering on Trump. What would he have said about poverty and the absence of Or let me put it this way. What would he have said about Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, Mr. Orthodox Jew, who led the charge to prevent single-payer health care in this country because of his cronies in Connecticut and the insurance companies? What would he have said about that? What do you think? And some things are just so obvious. What he would have said about the Iran-Contra deal, about arms shipments, about nuclear war. I mean, these things were, of course, issues even when he was alive. My uncle, my father's brother, who was a rabbi in London, came to America, and he was appalled when he saw somebody begging on the street on Broadway. How can it be? This is the richest country in the world, in the history of the world, and there's somebody begging? So I also mention this to say that this was a larger universe of my father's family.
So maybe just a final question, and then we'll open it up, which is, what do you wish? So clearly people know a lot of things about your father, but they probably don't know a lot of other things, right? Our memories are selective. There are certain kinds of books and certain moments and certain images that are canonical and others that are not well known. What is it that you want us to know and about your father?
So I would say there are a few things. One thing is the way he treated other people with so much respect, with kindness, with care. When it happened a couple of times that somebody passed away, Hillel Bavli, for example, or Ilya Shor, he organized a group of his colleagues, who were, of course, all men, professors, to get together to talk about making sure that the widows and children of these people had enough of an income. You know, it was tachlis. It wasn't just that he was sending condolences. It was practical. And because I don't want it to be too solemn, let me just tell you, one time, Pinchas Peli's wife came to talk to my father. Her husband had decided, after they have four kids already, he's going to get a PhD. He had no money. They come to America, he studied with my father, and they really were struggling. And these four children, they had a small apartment in Jerusalem. And she came to my father, and she just poured out her heart to him. And you know what he said? She thought he would tell her, you should say Tillim, you should say the Psalms, you should pray harder. He listened to her and he said, Penina, you need to get a dishwasher. He told her that he had just gotten a dishwasher in our house and it was so wonderful. Isn't that nice? All right, I think he was also, he really was someone who worked and read and studied constantly. And I sometimes think, I worry that some of my students just don't understand what that means. Their college is about friends and sports and yes, I'm studying as well, but it's just one of a few things. No, for my father, study was the number one. And that's how you had to read everything and to read, but also to read it critically. If you pick up a few pages of one of my father's books and you count the number of sentences that are negative versus positive, a lot of them are negative, maybe the majority. He's critical, he thinks critically. He would listen to something and then a nice idea, and then what's wrong with it? What's the next step? Now where do we go? He, not to be satisfied and not to be complacent, but always to be engaged and to be revving forward.
Should we open it up?
Sure.
I mean, I could ask you a lot more, but yeah, Ken.
From his father's house, meaning, I mean, obviously he must have been doing sacrilegious in the family system. No, it came from Chassidish at home, right? So you started reading secular works.
Marx?
Reading philosophy. What was that transition about?
You know, from what he and also other relatives who were from Europe have said to me is that in those days it didn't have such a negative. To go to university wasn't so negative and it wasn't so unusual. So even my father's sister, my aunt Gittel, went to classes in art history at the University of Vienna. It wasn't something treif. It wasn't something forbidden in that sense.
Why was the base operative system established?
Well,
for that very purpose, so that girls from Hasidic homes would not go to the university, that they wouldn't come in contact with secular trends, with socialism, Zionism, things like that.
Yeah.
There must have been something very unusual in the family system, I would imagine. Father wasn't supervising him, or what was it? There must have been mentors?
No, my father, I just want you to know, my father, even in Nazi Germany, you know, he was in Germany until October 38. He was using Nagelwasser. You know what that is? The first thing when you wake up in the morning, you put water on and you say a prayer. So he never stopped being from, ever. But he read philosophy. He was very smart, you know? And I don't think it was viewed as something treif. I will tell you, my father's father died when my father was 9. But his uncle was the Novominska Rebbe, who was right there. But also it was Warsaw. And maybe Warsaw is a little different from a small village.
Dina?
To what extent did you growing up, did your father's house and your house, to what extent did you live in the shadow of the Holocaust? How did that shape your childhood, the losses that your father experienced directly in terms of his family?
I think there were a lot of families in those days who had a similar, that is, there were some things, some words that were not spoken, and the not speaking was very loud. Some things you don't say. Some things are too painful to be brought up. You can't casually talk about someone who's just been killed. It's too painful. I'm named for my father's mother who was murdered. And I think it's not just me, but I think for my father to have, or for anyone to have a child who's named for someone who was killed, that also is a complexity emotionally. My father used to tell me that I reminded him when I laughed of his sister Gittel. I had her laugh. But there was a presence always, and then there were the relatives who would come over. My father was very close to his family, and I am too. The Hasidic family, to the Boyana Rebbe, the Novominska Rebbe, and especially the Kapichenitzer. So that family also had brought Europe, and Yiddish, spoke only Yiddish, brought it to New York.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
I'm Steve.
Steve.
Yes. My understanding is that he knew Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Schneerson in Berlin. Is that correct?
In passing, yes.
Did he have relationships with them or people like that when he was in New York? Did he have intellectual conversation with them? Was it a dialogue? Or how did he fit into this European, this sort of astonishing group that came from Berlin like that?
He wasn't close to them, but they of course knew each other. My father's sister, who was 17, got married. My father was 3 in Warsaw, so she was much older, and moved to Vienna with her husband, who was their cousin, the Kapichenitzer Rebbe. And their eldest child, Chava, married Zalman Gerari, who was a very important person in the Hasidic world. He's the person to whom the Lubavitcher Rebbe went once a year for bracha, for blessing. So there was some presence of Lubavitch in our family in that way. But I could say more about that, but it's not necessary. And Soloveitchik, yes, they knew each other, and Rav Soloveitchik came to our home at least once that I remember very vividly, and he came when we were sitting Shiva for my father, and so. Yeah.
Manuel?
Just 4 points. When you say your father was studying all the time, what was he reading? Gemara, philosophy, German philosophy. Second, in which language did he think? Did he work intellectually? Third, what did he think about Martin Buber? And fourth, what did he think about Zionism?
Wow, so that was great. You want to come sit here?
So, first of all, what did he study? Yes, German philosophy, but also books in English, including occasionally history or political book. For example, when he had a heart attack and he was recovering and he was supposed to rest and relax, he read Isaac Deutscher's 3-volume biography of Trotsky. So that was relaxation for him. He didn't read novels, but when he first came to this country, he did buy books about the English language, and he read Shakespeare and a lot of poetry. And he wrote books, of course, in 4 languages. And when he was working, what language was he thinking? It depended what language he was writing in. So when he wrote his Hebrew book, Torah Min HaShemayim, he was doing it in Hebrew, and all the texts were in his head. He didn't go to the library to look up a source. He had it. And that's why there are also some footnote errors, because he remembered the wrong page number. So what, you know. But he remembered the text. The point is that he remembered the text. Doesn't matter if he got the page number wrong, and somebody can correct it. But and then he wrote in Yiddish, he was thinking in Yiddish, and he felt to write a book about the Kotzker, you have to do it in Yiddish. It just doesn't work in either language. What he was reading, I'll just tell you, on Shabbos, on the Sabbath, he was reading Hasidic texts for the most part. And he knew, he actually won a Guggenheim. Yeah, in fact, I wonder how many father-daughter Guggenheims there are. But anyway, he won a Guggenheim to write a biography of the Baal Shem Tov, which he never got around to completing. And there was a fire in the seminary library, and the books were destroyed. Anyway, and about Buber, yeah, they knew each other. They knew each other in Germany, and they remained in contact and corresponded in German. Buber was much older. He was an older generation. And my father also, what should I say, the relationship was very much geprägt. How do you say? Geprägt. It was...
Formal, stylized?
Stylized as in a German professor-student relationship or older to younger relationship. And my father retained that. And if you're, there's a lot of that still goes on in Germany, actually. I'll just tell you one anecdote, shall I?
Yes, please.
So my father was invited by Buber to have tea in Heppenheim, which is outside Frankfurt, where he lived. It was in 1936, and my father went there and... he said, at the table, there were several people, and Buber was running an adult Jewish education center in Frankfurt, the Yiddishes Lehrhaus, which he asked my father to take over. My father actually taught Buber how to speak modern Hebrew before Buber went to Palestine. Anyway, at tea, they were discussing what they should teach adults about the prayers, and Buber said they should teach adults the words of the prayer book. What prayer, what blessing you say with this food or that food? And my father said... No, not prayers. This is gebet, sondern beten. Not the prayers, but rather how to pray. That's what you should teach. How do you pray? And I think that little anecdote captures so much about my father and his work.
So he was more Buberian than Buber. Because that's Buber.
Right, that's
Well, they came from such different, Buber was really coming from a more secular framework.
Right.
Into this, so Buber as a young man visited the Hasidic world, and your father grew up in it.
Yes.
And so they were coming from such opposite directions.
Yes.
So, I knew that he had taken over the school, but I just kind of wondered about their relationship. aside from that time in Germany, they really weren't in the same place for very long. How close were they?
Well, they saw each other in Israel. And Buber came to America and visited our home.
Yeah, Buber came once. How often did your father go to Israel?
I can't count, but several times. Buber died in 65, and we happened to be in Israel that summer and went to the funeral.
What about Zionism?
Oh, Zionism. Oh. Zionism, and then Leanne. Leanne had a question. Do you not want to talk about that, or?
I would say, you know, he wrote a book called Israel and Echo of Eternity, which he wrote right after the Six-Day War, 1967. And I want to do it justice, so just very quickly, he said in there, for example, we do not worship the soil. I mean, it's a book that reflects a direction that is not the direction of Gush Emunim or of Meir Kahana and so forth, or Rav Kook the Younger. It's not that direction. It's a different direction. He also went to Israel to lecture many times. In the summer of 65, we were there for 2 months because President Zalman Shazar invited my father to lecture because he felt that young people in Israel were losing a sense of what it is to be Jewish, which continues to be a problem to this day. And I think it's especially a crisis to the Israelis who come to this country and think that they're still Israeli and don't know what it is to be a Jew. And they mock, many of them mock Jewish. Okay. Anyway, he also talked about certain things that need to change. You can't just have an Orthodox rabbinate. Not everybody can be Orthodox. There has to be room for something more. And why is there only a mashgiach in the butcher store? A mashgiach is a ritual supervisor to make sure the food is kosher. There should also be a mashgiach in the banks and in the businesses. And he said, if you think Israel has overcome Golis, has overcome the diaspora, no, he said, look at the Independence Day, how they celebrated with airplanes and tanks and a parade. He said, that's Golis. He also said some bar mitzvah fairs are Golis, by the way. But anyway, yeah, there's more to say, but I'll...
Yeah. Leanne?
Sure, I'm going to stand up because I'm on the edge. I have kind of a personal question that I've been dying to ask you, maybe. I can remember the moment when, having read the Sabbath for the first time and been like, it's so beautiful, I was then exposed to something I hadn't been as a child, the reality of Orthodox kind of Shabbat performance and women in the kitchen working very hard while men sat around this beautiful table. And it ruined it for me, right? And I had that moment, and I said, wow, I wonder if you could speak to, like, the place of women, because they're not there in the vision in the Sabbath, but I wonder if you could speak to what that was like in your home. I mean, I love when you mentioned the dishwasher, and, like, what were women at your Shabbat table? You know, would you speak to that for a moment?
Sure. So I think, one of the things I think is important is not just the Sabbath, let's say, but the anticipation. And my father has a short essay on Yom Kippur. It's in the book I edited, Moral Grandeur and Spiritual Audacity. It's just 2 pages. And he talks there about the anticipation of Yom Kippur being even more profound than the day itself. So in our home, Friday morning was busier than usual, and shopping. And we would buy the challah and go to the grocery store and so on. In the afternoon, there was a cooking. And it got a little bit more intense and intense with each hour. My father came home, of course, early from his office to get ready. And then in the last minutes before, there was always this sort of rush of getting the blech on the stove. The
muksa, right?
No, before Shabbos, put the blech on the stove and make sure that there was enough water that had been boiled and so forth. And then, with all of that sort of nervous rush, then we would go into the dining room and kindle the lights. And then we usually went into the living room where we had a view of Riverside Drive of the Hudson River, and we could see the sun setting as we faced west. And I felt physically transformed. We occasionally, not that often, occasionally we would be invited to some colleague's home for Shabbat dinner, or sometimes we would have guests. And I think those were very wonderful moments. Of course, everybody sat together. And then in the morning, we went to the synagogue, we came home, there was a very simple lunch, and then my parents wanted to take a nap, which was the hard time for me because I had to be quiet. And then they would wake up, and actually Elie Wiesel used to come over when he was, before he was married, but he lived in the area. Nobody knew anything, nobody knew who he was, he hadn't published very much. And he and my father would take a walk, and then for an hour in the park, and then they would come up and have tea. And then make Havdalah, the prayer at the end of the Sabbath. Sometimes we would have guests for Shabbat afternoon tea, usually students, some faculty, but students. And we sat at the table and there was tea and there would usually be cheese and crackers or something like that, and then coffee cake or some, we don't call it coffee cake anymore, but some kind of simple cake. And then we would make Havdalah. I mean, everybody would daven and then make Havdalah. So I felt, I think that what's important is following the rhythm of the day, of when the sun sets. I remember once going to someone's home, and I got there, and it was already dark. We came to the table, and then they lit the candles. And I understand that. Yeah, and I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying that's a different experience than knowing that the Sabbath is coming and you have to hurry and get ready, and then you light the, and then it's just done. And you light the candles.
So I appreciate that because I think it somehow I had internalized that, having seen a lot of the work by women to create a thing, that a kind of sense that didn't feel the same. And hearing you, your involvement and the kind of integration helps me a lot in kind of rehabilitating that awkward moment.
Should this be the last, maybe? This, yes.
While we're on the feminine aspect of everything, I had the pleasure of meeting your mother. She came to speak at the Kehillah in Washington, D.C., and had a conversation with her. You look something like her, a little bit, just a little bit. And I had the pleasure of speaking with her after. It was lovely, enjoyed it very much. And then I'm a therapist, I asked her, did she have a photograph of the march? And she was kind enough to send me one. So it has been in my therapist's office ever since.
That's funny.
And it was just a lovely exchange. And I wanted to ask, did she, what happened to her career as a concert pianist?
Okay, so my mother grew up in Cleveland. Her parents had come over from Russia and Poland. And she studied in Cleveland, first with Samuel Clemens, and then with Severn Eisenberger. Cleveland, you know, Cleveland is a great city with great music. And there were two conservatories at that time. The orchestra is incredible. Severn's Hall is magnificent. It's just an unbelievably fantastic orchestra, and the acoustics are amazing. Anyway, Severn Eisenberger had come over from Poland. He was a child prodigy and had studied with a student of Czerny, Karl Czerny, who had been Beethoven's assistant. So there was a nice lineage there. So what happened? There was some kind of scandal in Cleveland. He got a divorce or something. Yeah. And he had to leave town as a result. And he went to Cincinnati. And my mother, who by this time was in her 30s, decided to go to Cincinnati and study with him, continue studying with him. And that's where she met my father. And my mother's parents, meanwhile, moved from Cleveland to LA. And my mother went to visit them, and she played there for Arthur Rubinstein, the great Arthur Rubinstein, the heartthrob. And he suggested that she study with Edward Stroyemann, who was a very well-known pianist. So she went to New York, and she studied with Stroyemann, and married my father, and obviously lived with him, and that was it. But she never... My mother was very nervous about playing in front of other people, even other friends, let's say. She would get extremely nervous before any kind of, yeah. And so she really couldn't be a concert pianist. She really wanted to be, and she played incredibly well. She could sight read anything. She had, really was an amazing pianist. That was clear. She used to play a lot of chamber music with friends, piano trios, piano quartets, and violin piano sonatas. And I grew up with a lot of Brahms, especially, but Schubert and Mozart and so on. And I even studied the cello for a while so that I could play chamber music with her. But I don't think she, so she liked to tell people that because she had a child, she had to give up her concert career. And she said that to the day, but she actually could never have done it because it made her too upset. So that any time she even invited a few friends over to listen to her, she got very upset.
Did she teach?
Just to tag on to that, fortunately I've been able to hear you speak here many times.
Oh.
One time you mentioned how much your father loved to sit
Yes, I did too. Yes, we all did. And I would beg her to play a certain Chopin piece that I loved, the 24th Prelude. That's anyway, yes, it was great. And I loved it. I loved having the chamber music. And my mother's favorite thing to do was to sit at the piano and play for hours and hours. And so she was perfectly happy when my father went to his study and she went to her piano, and that was that. So, yeah, that it was ideal in that sense. He had his books, she had her piano.
Wow.
Yes.
And they both had you, and now we get you a little bit. Thank you all for coming.